Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, is loyalty finally paying off? Especially for savers, we look at the banks and building societies pledging the best returns for existing customers. Also today, we are a step closer to Britcoin. Who will pay the price as the UK pushes for net zero? Would you be a home booster? And are Lee turned from beach hut snob to full-on fanboy? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, after years of saying that loyalty quite simply doesn't pay in finance, it seems the tide could be a turning. First, the watchdog announced that insurance companies will finally be banned from penalising loyal customers with higher renewal costs. Now it seems that some banks or building societies are doing the right thing by their savers. Lee, loyalty. Loyalty in insurance is something that we talk about a lot. But what's it like in the world of savings?
Well, you're right, Georgie. We do talk about insurance quite a lot, and people get quite frustrated when they get their renewal policy come through the post and they think, oh, hold on a minute, this seems higher than last year. And then they go and investigate, or they don't, and have to do that whole haggle dance where they go and look for a better deal and then tell their current insurer that they've got this better deal. Can they match it? That's been going on for a very long time. And there have been moves in the past to do things like show on the renewal letter, for example, how much you were paying the year before and all that kind of stuff. So in the terms of insurance, we talk about it quite a lot. In terms of savings and actually just banking in general, you could say that loyalty has never really been at the forefront of banks and some building societies' minds, is what I would argue. If you think about something like current accounts, for example, you quite often get lured in with a £100 bonus or something like that. They're not going to keep paying you £100 bonuses every year to stay with them, because that would be a bonkers system to keep getting paid to keep your bank account with them. And some people will switch, like the new bank that they're with, because they've got good customer service or other things, and say, actually, this is a good place to hold my money. In terms of savings, we're a little bit more lethargic as a nation as a whole. We stick money away in savings accounts. And there was a study in 2018 that suggests that we very, very rarely then move that money around or shop around or do anything with it. So there was a study by the FCA 3 years ago that said that just 1 in 10 holders of easy access savings accounts and ISAs switched in the last 3 years up to that report date. And meanwhile, accounts opened more than half a decade ago, which is 60% of the entire savings market, were being paid 0.42 percentage points less than newer savings accounts. That could have grown since then. People kind of sometimes forget about where the money is, or just think, oh, it's such hassle moving it when the rate gets chopped to another account. And that is really, really prominent at the moment, because moving your money from a 0.05% account, let's say in easy access, to the Best Buy of 0.5%, is not going to set your pulse racing. It's not going to set your world alight. But that is the kind of savings world that we're currently facing. But there have been little chinks of light coming through in terms of loyalty. I would say we mentioned this on a podcast a little while back in ISA season, when Nationwide introduced an ISA that was Best Buy by quite some way, an 18-month fix, which was only open to existing Nationwide customers. And I think people like that. It came off sale pretty quickly, so I'm guessing that quite a lot of money went into that account. And people like to feel like they are being rewarded for staying with the same financial firm. I think it's plain and simple that that kind of strategy works, but it's not as simple as that. Because if you're a big bank and you know you're safe in the knowledge that people are going to put money in easy access accounts and they've been there for a long time, and you could pay them absolute pittance because they're not going to do anything, you know what they're going to do. They're not going to start offering you exclusive rates to move that money away, because it would be detrimental to their business. So they're not going to do it. But we've seen that with Nationwide. And Nationwide have also launched a few savings lotteries and things. And you could argue that they're a gimmick. And again, we spoke about this on the podcast recently. But at least it's something going on in the savings world. The other one is Yorkshire Building Society. It's decided to up the rate on some of the accounts that some of its customers have, which I think's a nice move. But again, it costs them money, you know, but they can do it, so they're going to do it. And it might keep those customers more likely to recommend them to friends to say, hey, look, I'm being treated fairly by my building society. And there's a couple of challenges as well that have launched over the years that have kind of had this pledge never to pay worse rates to existing savers than they would to new ones. So Ford Money, which is the financial arm of the car manufacturer in the UK, does that. So it won't offer new customers a better rate than existing customers. So it's a real tough one for banks and building sites, because they obviously have a fine balance between the money that they're getting in, the money that's being held, if they're offering easy access, ISAs, fixed rates. The best thing that savers can do really is to shop around and not rely on thinking, oh, I've been here for a long time and they're going to be treating me fairly. It's to dig out your old accounts, have a look at what rate it slipped down to, have a look what else is out there. And I'm saying rates are low, Georgie, but again, there have been little signs that things are going back the other direction, hopefully. I mean, they can't go much lower, can they? And we'll start talking about negative savings rates soon if things don't start improving. And last week, we saw Aldermore Bank, another challenger, for example, launched a one-year fix at 1%, which doesn't sound, again, like much, but at least it was something paying over 1% again. And especially with inflation, which has gone quite a leap in the last set of figures. So, you know, maybe that's a sign that a few more challengers might start offering better rates, but there's a big but here. I looked at the rate on the Aldermore one-year account, which launched last Friday, and lo and behold, today it's already gone down to 0.75%. So it's quite clear that they filled their coffers pretty quickly. They'll have targets, these smaller challengers. They can't quite suck up as much money as the bigger players, and they would have hit it, and they've had to cut the rate. The two-year fix, which pays a little bit more than that, is still at the same rate. But you know, again, it remains to be seen if that'll get cut soon as well.
Simon, this and more generally with the insurance that we had story a couple of weeks ago, is loyalty starting to pay? Are businesses getting it?
I think I would always work on the basis that loyalty doesn't pay and be cynical and check. So I think that with the insurance stuff, insurers are being told not to bump up your premiums for no reason. Renewal quotes. And this is a very opaque situation. We talked about this on the podcast a couple of years back, and I wrote a column about it. My Halifax at the time, contents insurance, randomly went up by, something that amounted to like maybe nearly 30% or something. But they couldn't explain why. I contacted them. I said, well, look, can you tell me why it's gone up by so much? No. Well, there must be a reason. No. Well, can't you tell me? No, we don't have to tell you that, was the gist of the responses. And I think as a customer, if you're given a reason why something has gone up in price, then you can make your decision. You can understand it. You can decide whether to go with it or whether not to go with it. It's when prices go up for seemingly no reason whatsoever. And this is the classic one with car insurance, is you read stories about how car insurance costs have fallen, and the cost of insuring cars is falling across the industry because people are doing less miles, therefore they're having less accidents. You've had car insurers giving money back to people and things like that. And then you get your renewal quote and it's gone up. Why has it gone up? And they can't give you a good reason. And I think that even with the stuff that the FCA is bringing in, I would always check, you know, because you don't know until you've checked, right? So I would always do a price comparison search. Use maybe one or two price comparison sites. It literally takes less than 5 minutes. I had to insure a car the other day. It's so easy. It's so quick to do those comparisons. And then also go to the companies that aren't on the car insurance. Go to Direct Line, go to Aviva, who don't feature on those two ones. And then at least you know, because I certainly wouldn't take it for granted that just because they've been told to make sure that you don't get a loyalty penalty, that they're actually going to make loyalty pay in itself. With your bank and building society, again, I'd echo what Lee said. I would always go look at the Best Buy tables. This is money.co.uk/save. Our independent Best Buy tables, the best rates in there, updated as rates change, often on a daily basis, and see what there is on offer, because interest rates are rubbish at the moment. Okay, I mean, Lee was just explaining how the best, you know, we got excited about a best 1 year fix at 1%, and now it's been cut to 0.75%. That's absolute rubbish. But it's better than earning nothing on your savings, you know. And in terms of how loyalty doesn't pay, people, banks and building societies, even the ones who we think are doing the good things, Nationwide, for example, gets held up as a bit of an example. It's the biggest building society, doesn't do everything right, does do some stuff right, gets held up as an example. I've got an old savings account with Nationwide, Flexclusive Saver. Flexclusive, right? This is because I have a Flex account. So I get access to a special savings account. And I've had it for a while. Fortunately, I only have £3.24 in there. Now, do you know what my Flexclusive rate is? Okay, it's banded. So I'm in the £0.01, so a penny. I'm in the penny to £9,999.99. And I get, because I'm special and I've got a Flex account, 0.01% interest. Ooh. Look at me, eh? With my Flexclusive savings. I mean, that's pitiful. I've said before, I would rather a bank or a building society wrote to me and said, under the current circumstances, we're not going to pay you any interest. We've just decided to pay you zero, but we'll look after your money for you and you're protected up to the financial services compensation scheme limit. And if you want to do something better with your money, probably best to move it, rather than paid me 0.01%. That's just an insult. It's like, oh, we're not going to be honest enough to not pay you no interest whatsoever, but we'll pay you 0.01%. But I do have another loyalty account with Nationwide. Again, an old account. This one has £1.64 in it. This
big
is the
money, Simon.
I know, big money. Well, the thing is, you can't, right? So, okay, the reason why there is these small amounts of money in there is a lot of accounts that you have to have a pound, like open with a pound, have a pound into open. You have to, when you try to take all the money out, you have to leave a pound in there unless you close the account. And closing the account involves like a huge amount of rigmarole more than just taking the money out. And I must admit that it has occurred to me in the past that banks and building societies must be sitting on a cumulatively huge sum of money from all the people who can't be asked to properly close an account, so just leave a pound in there, or £1.64. I don't know where. I don't think the 64p's interest, because I think I would have had to have money in there for about 50 years to earn 64p's worth of interest. Anyway, this is a loyalty saver 15-year issue four. This has probably been superseded by other accounts. Okay, just to be clear, not to be mean to Nationwide, I've had this account for years, should have moved this money, haven't bothered because I can't bother to close the account. Now, I'm getting 0.25% in there. Again, not really great. Can be beaten elsewhere, but not awful, actually, in the context of easy access savings nowadays. But that's like the loyalty of the concept of just leaving your money in legacy accounts. And is that loyalty or is that inertia? I know you've got an issue with this. We've had this argument before. The loyalty stuff is when the building societies, and this is where I think it is worth saving with the building societies, give some of the money, some of the profits they're making back to their savers. So we talked about Yorkshire Building Society, okay? It's going to be giving some more of that back to savers in terms of bumping up their rates. Nationwide has a target to offer member benefits worth £400 million a year. In the form of additional value provided to its savers. Now, in its recent results, it revealed that it had undershot that target by £135 million after slashing its savings rates. But they said that they now want to try to exceed that target in the medium term in order to drag stuff back level. And that's where I think maybe the loyalty does get rewarded in the money that building societies give back to their customers from their profits. But I do think that you should always, always shop around and hopefully you'll find that your loyalty is genuinely being rewarded and you don't have to move. Or you might actually go, well, I've got £3,000 in a savings account and that tiny bit of extra rate that I'm getting from Bank X is only worth £3.30 a year to me versus sticking with my trusty old building society. So I'm going to stick with my trusty old building society. Mm. But you can make this, I think the important thing is to make an informed decision. It would be, you know, the sum total of my view.
Which is why I don't like the concept of loyalty. It's almost like, well, I'm not getting as good as I could do, but I'm going to stick with, you know, no, you're loyal to family, you're loyal to loved ones, but the idea of being loyal to your bank or your insurer, no. Hopefully you're making an informed decision. They've treated you well in the past. You've done all the reviews. They're offering you a decent price and you've decided to stay. And I do agree with keeping on taking a look around, because I was so aghast that my car insurance renewal quote was lower than the previous year. I was like, oh, I'm definitely going to take that. It's awful. Don't do as I do, people. Do as Simon says, because there could have been way better deals out there. But saying that, I quite liked the insurer.
I've got an idea for a bank or building society loyalty scheme for long-term customers. It's like, you know, this is the sort of the coffee shop thing where you go in and every time you get coffee, you get a stamp. My butcher does this. You go in, if every time you spend more than 20 quid, you get a stamp and then you get some money off, which is great. I think that your bank or building society, to reward idiots like me who've got about 15 million old accounts, they should give you a stamp every time you open a savings account. And once you've had 20 savings accounts with them, you get a tiny bit extra on your interest rate.
Yeah. Not convinced there, Simon. Right, Lee, the coin boy in the past, boys. We're going to talk about coins, but not the traditional type now. As Bitcoin continues to fall, we're not going to be talking about Bitcoin. Could Britcoin be about to rise? Do not adjust your sets. That is exactly what I just said. Britcoin. The Bank of England, as have other central banks as well around the world, been mooting whether to launch its own digital currency. But, Lee, academics, tech companies, consumer groups, payment firms, and perhaps hard coin enthusiasts have got a few concerns about this. They say they should only be introduced if it can deliver clear benefits. So Britcoin, Lee Boyce.
It should only be introduced if it has a launch party with Tony Blair and Noel Gallagher on the street, capturing that mid-90s, you know, real sort of Brit movement. That's the only way this could be acceptable. Listen, Britcoin has that kind of catchy, you know, the kind of play on Bitcoin. And I'll be honest with you, there's a lot of question marks for me about the Bank of England sort of getting involved in this. Look, I can see in a way that they'd be foolish not to be having a look at what's happening in terms of the cryptocurrency kind of movement. And wherever you sit with cryptocurrency, whether you think it's the next best thing and it's all going to the moon, or you think it's a load of nonsense and all it's doing is fueling organized crime and all that kind of stuff, you know, they still have to have a look at something that has become so prominent so quickly. As in, you know, a couple of years ago, probably average person on the street that you'd ask, maybe one in two, or maybe one in three would know a little bit about Bitcoin, a little bit about cryptocurrency. I would argue now that the majority will have at least a little bit of knowledge of what Bitcoin is and what cryptocurrencies are all about. Not intrinsic knowledge, because mm-hmm. it takes a lot of reading to go and have a look at blockchain and all that kind of stuff. But there are people out there who have made some serious money cryptocurrencies, and there's some people out there that have had their fingers completely burned. And as you say, Georgie, we've seen this year the price went absolutely up like a rocket at Bitcoin. Yeah. Kind of crashed back down to earth with a few sort of choice Elon Musk tweets, and then it's kind of gone on a little bit of it's gone up a little bit since. It's just a kind of topsy-turvy ride, and it's kind of worrying when someone like Elon Musk, who's obviously the Tesla boss and obviously a very prominent person on social media, can influence something that a lot of people have money linked to, you know, for exchanges and things. So Bank of England is right to have a look at this, and it has done kind of look in the past about who's buying cryptocurrency, you know, who the typical amount of money going in and all of that kind of stuff. Now the reason why I'm a little bit confused by this is that I don't know if you could really technically call it, won't be a cryptocurrency as people know it, as in it will, cryptocurrencies aren't backed by, you know, an asset or real currency. And I think that's what kind of people again get a little bit confused about. This would be tied to the pound to start with. So this is Bitcoin. It's going to be tied to the pound. It would be overseen by the Bank of England, and it'd be the same as a banknote, but in sort of digital form. So would it have the kind of, I'm guessing it's almost like trying to remove that physical money which a lot of, let's face it, a lot of us are used to now. A lot of people will have their card on their phone, you know, and they can just tap with their phone and use those kind of payment systems. Is it going to be something like that? And does all of that mean it just has a more of a tracking potential, and you know, to see spending habits, spending data, all of that kind of thing, which is the point of cryptocurrency.
Exactly.
One of the biggest points of cryptocurrency anyway is that it's meant to be anonymous. You know, it's meant to be sort of untrackable. It's meant to become like the anti-Big Brother kind of payment method. And actually people again with cryptocurrencies will say, well, where can you go and spend your Bitcoin? You know, show me how you spend it. And actually things have improved in that kind of way a little bit, in terms of being able to have an account where you can convert it into like a payment wallet and be able to spend it in shops and things. But I don't think many people want to do that, because most people are getting involved because they think they're shoving money into something like Bitcoin and there's only way is up. And they've heard their mate down the pub, or they've heard so-and-so has made, you know, a couple of grand shoving it in rather than sticking it in a savings account, you know, taking Simon's £3 out of his Nationwide account and sticking that in Bitcoin 5 years ago. I mean, what would that be worth now? And we've heard all sorts of stories like that. But yeah, this one, they're basically now saying that they're going to do some more consultation work on it, which I'm not surprised about, because getting your head around cryptocurrencies is a fiendishly complex endeavor. If you want to find out about it properly, you know, once you scratch below the surface, you end up in a real rabbit hole. And it's not just Bitcoin. There's lots of other different coins that are meant to have all different purposes. It just feels to me that when you've got a kind of some countries cracking down on stuff like Bitcoin, so like China, you know, I know the States are kind of are keen to it. Then you've got other countries like El Salvador that are now making Bitcoin a sort of like legal tender. It's obviously a lot of kind of division.
Lee, you can see why. I mean, El Salvador has 20% of their GDP comes from people sending money from abroad, so that's what they were thinking. And China, I imagine, want to crack down on digital currencies for exactly the reason you said, because of that anonymity. I would have suggested.
Exactly. Well, you fit the nail on the head there, Georgie. Yeah, exactly that. And that's what, you know, I guess I take a very neutral view of cryptocurrency, right? I don't think it's like the worst thing that's ever happened in the finance industry ever. But I also don't think it's like this new brilliant thing that's going to completely change the world of, you know, making payments. I just like to look at things with a kind of neutral view. And I think at the end of the day, if the Bank of England is actually being a bit proactive and having a look into any way to make something like this a future payment option, it's not a bad thing. It's just whether, you know, they get it right. They don't rush out something that's completely nonsense and completely unusable. And they do all of their due diligence on it. But for me, it just doesn't sound like a cryptocurrency. End of, you know, yeah. Looking at, reading between the lines.
Simon, I mean, Lee's just articulated, I think, very well there. Thank you, Lee. All of the main sort of thoughts and concerns with this is, what is in it for the Bank of England? It doesn't sound like cryptocurrency in any sort of form that we understand it. It sounds like, well, what we sort of have already. I guess the only difference they're saying is, one, because it's pegged to a currency, it's pegged to the sterling, then we won't see the wild swings in volatility, which is catching some investors out. And also it means access to central bank funding, which at the moment is only available to commercial banks. But I can't see what else is in it for them and what else is in it for us and the country.
Well, the idea behind central bank digital currencies, which is what Bitcoin would be one of, is that they are what's known as a stable coin. And a stable coin is something that its value doesn't wildly oscillate, as you said, because it's pegged to the value of something else. And there's an irony in that, because Bitcoin, obviously, if you're a true believer, is because the fiat money system, and that's not money based on fiats, is considered to be a broken system and needs to be replaced with a decentralized currency, i.e. Bitcoin. The problem with Bitcoin as a decentralized currency is its value compared to other stuff in the world, be that US dollars, pounds, how many Teslas you could buy for it, if Tesla will sell that to you on that given day, or anything else, swings around wildly. So, I mean, if you're looking at Bitcoin this week, it's actually up about 10%. If you're looking at it over the past month, it's down like nearly 50%. So is difficulty because it swings around so much. So you certainly wouldn't want a central bank digital currency to do that, so you peg it to something. The obvious thing to peg the Brit coin to would be sterling, the pound. The pound moves around, obviously, but it doesn't swing around by tens of percent a week. So you get a you get the equivalent of digital banknotes. Whoop-de-doo. I mean, you're telling that to a man who just looked up his £3.46 on his phone. That £3.46 to me just only exists digitally. I could go get that £3.46 from a nationwide branch. I could make them give me £3.46 in coins, but I'm not going to. It just exists digitally. If I ever actually move it, I'll move it digitally. I'll probably pay for something digitally. I very rarely use cash nowadays anyway. And most of the money that we use is in essence a kind of digital form. You buy your house, someone does some tapping on a computer and somebody else gets a couple of hundred thousand pounds. That money is created digitally. So what's the difference with a cryptocurrency? Well, the crucial difference with a cryptocurrency is that effectively it's code. That digital money that we're talking about in our bank accounts, in my savings account that is being created is it's effectively, money that is just money that exists in theory, but is logged somewhere in an account or something. The cryptocurrency is actually digitally creating currency, and it is controlled by the central bank. Now, there's an obvious advantage to this for the central bank. And there are some advantages that are being sold to for people. For example, it said that it would make could make transactions quicker, could lower the cost of transactions. You don't have all the middlemen in there. Effectively, the Bank of England would be the one middleman. Obviously, that has an impact on the banking system because the banking system is going to have less customer money going into it, have less of a part to play. And it could actually mean that you see costs rise. There was a warning this week that actually the cost of loans could rise owing to the fact that A, the banks wouldn't have people's money in the way that they do, or as much of people's money in the way that they do now. And also there'd be less competition because the Bank of England is not going to compete against itself. And is the Bank of England going to start lending people this digital money directly? I mean, who knows? But the great advantage is that A, the blockchain gives you that ledger so you can see what has gone on with transactions. So with a Bitcoin, for example, you can see every single transaction that's gone on. Bitcoin itself isn't a great currency because it's quite clunky. It's quite energy, it's very energy intensive. And also it's not the quickest thing to make transactions with. There are other cryptocurrencies that are much better for making transactions with. And that's what the excitement about Ethereum is. And the cryptocurrencies that are built on the Ethereum system is that they're effectively much better as a way of transacting. But the other great advantage for a central bank is that it gives it a much bigger lever to pull in terms of monetary policy, because we're at the point where interest rates in the UK are 0.1%. They can't go much further. We've talked about negative rates, but the problem with negative rates is, well, there is something you can do against negative rates where you're actually being charged for leaving money in the bank. It's like you just don't put the money in the bank. You just keep hold of the money. There's a interesting article I read in The Economist the other week where there's a large amount of unexplained cash floating around the British economy. They can't work out where it's gone. Basically, lots of people have taken money out and they would have expected it to show up by now, and it's just never shown up. They still think there's some people still sitting on cash that they took out before the lockdowns because there was a little bit of a run on the cash machines. It was like, right, I'm going to go get some money out just in case the banking system collapses. That's never gone back in there. And because you're not earning any returns on your money, there's no incentive to put it into the bank. They think there's also been growth in the black economy. Obviously there's people off, on furlough. Some of those, they can actually work and earn other money, but some of them might be doing it cash in hand. And so that they don't have to pay any tax on it and things like that. So there is this unexplained chunk of money. If you have digital currency, if you have cryptocurrency, you don't have that problem. There's no unexplained money. This is why central banks love money in electronic form, and they can go negative with rates, and you will feel it immediately. You can't just take your cash out of the bank. They can do things like helicopter money more easily. They would even be able to do something, for example, like imagine a crisis in 10 years' time. We've got Bitcoin, we've got a cryptocurrency, and the government comes up with some support package with the Bank of England. Bank of England just puts that money straight into people's names, straight into people's accounts. No messing around. But in the other way, they could take money off people. And the one place major economy that does now have its own cryptocurrency is China. It's got a digital one, and it's positioning it for international use. It wants it to kind of go up against the dollar, but also it gives the Chinese authorities that thing that they love having lots of, and that's control over people. So I don't know whether you would see the widespread adoption of a Bitcoin in the UK, or whether you'd see a pushback against it. It's who knows.
In some, Simon, will we get one? And if so, when?
I think we'll almost certainly get one. I think we'll almost certainly see almost every major economy release
in the next 5 years.
Definitely their own version of a cryptocurrency. I can't see why they wouldn't do it. The cryptocurrency genie's out the bottle. It's not going away.
Does that in turn make crypto investing, and this is the hardest question to answer, more or less predictable or volatile or favorable, as it were? Because if central banks were on board with this idea, is that going to dwarf cryptocurrency? Is it going to boost cryptocurrency? That's a hard question. Sorry, Simon.
Well, it depends how you think about it, doesn't it? I don't think it's necessarily positive for Bitcoin. If we take Bitcoin as the example, it's not necessarily positive for Bitcoin because there's more competing digital currencies, but people aren't holding Bitcoin because they want to hold a currency.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't suddenly switch to the crypto dollar or the crypto pound or the crypto one. They're holding Bitcoin because they see it as an investment for a number of reasons, but they also see it as an investment against the monetary system, not an investment in the monetary system. And gold is a store of value. People hold gold. They pay far more for gold than it's actually worth in essence, and gold. There's currencies all around the world. Currencies basically replaced gold. Gold came, but it's a long-term store of value because people used to spend the damn thing. It'd be very inconvenient to spend gold. Much, much easier to spend a paper note. But even though all those currencies around the world still exist, people still hold gold. But Bitcoin's got, a good couple of thousand years to go before it really becomes the equivalent of digital gold. But I think it would be a positive for it. And also I do see, when I see stories talking about like regulatory crackdowns, tougher regulations, things like that on crypto, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing for people who are invested in crypto. I think it will cause more short-term volatility, but ultimately the more it's regulated, the more attractive it becomes to people. Mm-hmm. Whether the price of Bitcoin at $37,000 or $64,000 or $10,000 or even back to $5,000 is justified by any of that, I literally do not know.
Well, we'll have to see, won't we? Talking about future and predictions and all that, government continuing to plow ahead with plans to reach net zero by 2050. Let's go there, because it seems a significant number of UK homes cannot join them on that journey. Some 1.7 million have a very poor energy efficiency rating that simply cannot be improved. Now, this is according to new research from Rightmove. Lee, EPCs, these are like energy performance certificates. Every house gets one. It's sort of A to G, I think. And obviously A is the best and G is not great. So what is the government wanting to do with these? What is the significance of this story for particularly those 1.7 million UK homes?
Well, it's all about making your home as energy efficient as possible. And of course, we've had all of these sort of new targets set by the government in the last few years in all kind of areas and aspects of lives, including housing stock. And they're talking about all homes reaching a C rating by 2035 and earlier for private rental places. So if you're a landlord, there's already been some sort of movements to get you to improve the energy efficiency of your home. To do that, things like loft insulation, wall cavities, all of those kind of things, double glazing, triple glazing. There's lots of little improvements that you can make in order to improve the energy efficiency of your home. Unfortunately, Georgie, there's a lot of homes in Britain that were built in a time where we had no thought about anything to do with climate change. We just built homes with whatever were the best materials at the time, and that falls short of current building standards. There's a lot of Victorian housing stock around. There's a lot of Victorian housing stock around close to where I live, and actually in the top 10 list I saw Southend and Castle Point, which are areas that are literally directly next to me, and it's rows and rows and rows of Victorian properties that are unlikely to be able to have that kind of improvement to get to this target rating. And actually we've seen, I've been quite interested in this in the last sort of 6 to 12 months, is major lenders starting to offer slightly better rates to people who are buying homes that have a slightly better energy rating than other homes. It's almost like encouraging you, rewarding you for buying a more energy efficient home. Now I have one big problem with this, and it probably you'll hear why. The Green Homes Grant, which came out, which was launched by the government, it was actually not the most crackpot idea that they've ever had, and actually would have made sense if they'd done it right. And this is a classic example of coming out with what felt like a really sort of hashed plan, making this pot of money available. This pot of money gets made available, right, for you to make improvements to your home. Let's say you can have double glazing. You've not got double glazing yet, you know, and you wanted to use it for that. You could go on this website, you could check what you were eligible for from this grant, get a tradesperson to come and give you a quote and do the work. Now, the problem with that was that they put a real short expiry date on how quickly it was that you could use this money. And tradespeople, as we've mentioned on this show a few times, I would say in the last few months, are incredibly busy at the moment. You know, we've got more homes being built at the moment. Around here, the amount of new homes that are getting put up, you know, left, right, and centre, requires skilled tradespeople to do this kind of work. A lot of them are swamped. If you're a good tradesperson, you're quite likely to be booked up months in advance. And this pot of cash was quite difficult to use. And then they just cut it. There's a cut it, just like that. It just makes no sense. It makes me want to bang my head against the wall. I don't know why they couldn't have just made it a bit easier. Perhaps it will be relaunched in a kind of different way, because it was meant to create all of these sort of like eco-friendly jobs of like tradespeople coming around doing this work. All it did was rush people into not being able to do it, and you know, sort of sharky people knocking at the door going, someone knocked on my door and said, hi, are you the homeowner? And I was like, well, yeah. Well, have you heard about this Green Homes Grant? And I was like, yeah, dude, look, literally just been writing about the budget.
Wrong person to say that to.
Just gonna hear him out. And he's just coming up with all of this nonsense. And I'm just thinking, why does it have to be like this? Why isn't there just an easier solution? So I don't know what happens to this housing stock now, Georgie, these 1.7 million homes that Rightmove are talking about that can't achieve a C rating. And of course, the government must know that there are homes that can't meet those targets. And surely those homes just have to be exempt from the targets. It's not like we're going to pull them down and start all over again. So
also, Lee, I understand there's something like these are the ones that cannot be improved, but there's also about 19 million homes under C rating. So if we are going to get these mortgages that we were proposed, that, you know, people are going to get worse rates, or, you know, are they going to be able to remortgage? Are we going to have people, you know, mortgage prisoners and all those sorts of things? Or are they going to be forced to fork out, you know, I saw some figures on this as money, £3,000 to £18,000 to get their home sellable?
Well, surely the correct policy would be to say, right, if you've got a D, E, F or G home, we can get you something like an interest-free loan to make these improvements, and you've got a few years to use it and you can go and do it, rather than just saying, right, go and spend 20 grand getting it up to a C energy efficiency rating. People just won't want to do that. You know, the long and short of it is, it's a struggle for many to get on the housing ladder as it is, let alone then telling them, yeah, fork out an extra load of money to go and improve the energy efficiency. And it's one of those things where you don't really see much improvement, I would argue. Yeah, it might be slightly warmer in the winter and it retains heat more, but it's not a tangible thing, is it? Like a hot tub or something that someone might go and actually fork out and have some fun with. So it's quite difficult to persuade people. But my hunch is, Georgie, my hunch is over the coming years, this will become more on the forefront. And I think that that there will be some sort of schemes and things made available to start making these improvements and improve the efficiency of this housing stock. But it is the majority that is under the C rating. I think it's something like 3 in 5 homes or something isn't meeting that target.
And I genuinely think that we're going to struggle to ever really properly solve this problem in this country. It's not unusual in the UK to live in a house that's more than 100 years old. I mean, that's just not considered unusual. And that, you know, if you were to go over to America and tell people that, they think that's hilarious. It's always funny when you watch the American tourists going around and they're just looking at things going, I mean, how old is this?
Mine is about 300 years that I'm living in at the moment.
But even with, you know, so my house is a 1960s house. It's built in 1962, right? The energy efficiency is not very good at all. The construction's not great. Now you can do stuff about that. It's going to cost you money, but we're going to extend this house and renovate this house, and we'll do that at the time. But if you go upstairs in this house where it's like tile hung, right, there's almost nothing behind those tiles, and it is roasting hot in the summer and it's freezing cold in the winter, but you can do something about that when you do the work. It's still going to cost you money and everything like that. But if you go, for example, to London, the biggest city in the country, you know, and what do first time buyers and people and home movers want to buy in London? They don't want to buy new houses. They don't want to buy new build places. They don't really want to buy the 60s stuff either that much. You know, that's kind of a bit niche. What they really want is they want the Victorian stuff and the Edwardian stuff, and the Georgian stuff, or the stuff that's even older than the Victorian stuff. And when you're a first-time buyer, splashing out your £400,000 to buy a one-bedroom flat in London, right? You're going on, you want that Victorian conversion, right? Now, firstly, that is a converted flat in something that was originally a house. Depending on when that conversion was done, it may have been done to a differing standard. And a lot of them haven't been done that well, right? And then there's the building itself. Now, you might be a share of freeholder and you can all get together and agree to improve the energy efficiency of the building itself. But doing the building itself, that's a freehold issue. That's not just you in your flat. You're limited into what you can do in your flat. But not everybody in the building might be in agreement. They might not see sinking a few £1,000 into improving the energy efficiency of the building as their priority. They might not have the money. Mm-hmm. You might have it might not be that you own a share of freehold. You might be a leaseholder, and the landlord who owns that building quite likely has very little interest whatsoever in making it much more energy efficient. But actually, even if you did try to replace all of the single pane glass sash windows with new double glazing, you might find that the council's got something to say about that. And you're not actually allowed to, because in lots of places you can't do that. So you might have to get much, much more. You can get, you know, wooden sash window double glazing, but it's much, much more expensive. And you could spend a long time trying to make your property more energy efficient, but there's a problem, isn't there? You've just had to scrimp and save and probably go begging to the bank of mum and dad and gran and granddad and take on a mortgage that's more money than you ever wanted to borrow in your life to get yourself your little one bedroom flat. You haven't got like another £5,000 to drop on insulating it. And that story plays out in so many places. Obviously London is an extreme example, but there's the same story across towns and cities and rural locations as well, across the whole of the country, where, you know, people want the old houses and they scrimp and save to buy them and they pay a lot of money for them, and they just don't have the money to do it or the time or the inclination. And in many cases, you can't really do it. So I don't think we're ever going to get to where the sort of government talk says that we will get to.
Simon, talking about the bank of mum and dad, talking about difficulty getting on the housing ladder, home boosters. Just briefly, what are home boosters and who are Tembo?
Okay, so a home booster, basically Tembo will broker you an interest-only mortgage on your parents' home. That allows them to release some money to boost your deposit. The money is obviously secured on your parents' home, so your parents now have a new mortgage on their home that has gone into funding you buying a home. The obvious slight issue with this is that your parents then couldn't sell your home until like you could afford to pay them back because the money's been secured on their home. But it would give your, you give your child or daughter, sorry, your son or daughter, your child, whatever they are, they get a bigger deposit. It helps them get on the housing ladder. Obviously, that's a big thing for lots of people, but not everybody has large sums. Not all banks of mum and dad have large sums of money to hand over. And it means that parents can use the value of their property to help people out. But it might prove to be more expensive than just going out, just getting an interest-only mortgage yourself. And also the thing with interest-only mortgages, you've got to remember that money needs to be paid back in full. You're just paying the interest on it. When I first had this story pitched to me by Helen, I was kind of hoping that there was someone who worked out some way to actually just make the bank of mum and dad a bank and like have them, like they were effectively just lending the money in a, you know, it was like, yeah, they just use their own home as like a bank in some way to lend people the money. I was kind of hoping that it also came with some form of cryptocurrency overlay or something that it could tick all the boxes. But yeah,
no,
basically it's an alternative. To it's an alternative to equity release, I guess.
Worried.
I'm always worried.
There we go. That's your job, isn't it, Simon? Well, if you don't fancy a full big size house, what about Lee? A beach hut? I don't think it'd be quite so comfy. But your latest consumer column taking you to many places, Lee. You've experienced many things. So tell us about your latest discovery. We found something out about yourself, Lee. You're a bit of a snob, aren't you?
It's been a journey of self-discovery, Georgie, about my sort of love-hate with beach huts. Now, you know, I live close to the coast, and there's some lovely beach huts down in Thorpe Bay, some of them very nicely painted in their colourful pastel colours. And I've been around the UK and seen some lovely ones, Bournemouth, for example, very nice. And I'm not too far away from places like Walton-on-the-Naze, Frinton. Got some lovely beaches in Essex. Got one of the longest coastlines of any county in the whole of England. And it's a lovely place to go in for a little day out. But I always thought, what is the point of a beach hut? I've just never really kind of got it. Anyway, a few months ago, my wife had a phone alarm go off at about 5 to 8. And I was like, what's this all about? She was like, I've got to get onto this beach hut booking website. And I thought, have you lost the plot? What's this all about? But this new beach hut was going up from this company in a place called Mersey, which is close to Colchester. It's in a little coastal tidal road that you have to cross. Been there a few times. It's pretty non-built up for a sort of seaside place. It's quite refined and it's quite nice. So anyway, 8 o'clock, she gets on. She books it in for the Sunday that's just gone for the bank holiday. And she refreshes the page about 3 to 5 minutes later, and it's just a sea of red. They're all booked out. It's booked out within minutes. And there's been a lot written about this year, about how people have kind of got into beach huts. And it's a two-pronged thing. Firstly, obviously, people kind of writing off being able to travel abroad this year. And also, I think there's been quite a rise in the sort of social media aspect of these. You know, they look colourful, they look quite nice. There's a few celebs that have going on to these beach huts. They've swapped their Ibiza jollies and all that for a little beach hut in Essex that they've been gifted for the day. So for 75 quid for the four of us and also my daughter, we rocked up, got there. It was lovely, all really nicely done. 75 quid, I know, I thought that sounded like a lot of money, but you divide that between four people and we were there for 10 hours, you started to crunch that into an hourly sort of
price. Your daughter paying her way, Lee? I
mean, well, she's the fifth person. I didn't include it. It was four adults and her. And actually, I worked it out over the hours, as you do as a financial journalist and a complete boring person, and thought, actually, this is not bad value. We had a really nice time. And I've started looking into, for my column this week, how prices of beach huts to book have been rising. And actually, 75 quid is pretty reasonable, some that I've seen. And how the actual prices of buying them have gone up something like 40-odd percent in the last year. And buyers are seeing them as actually quite a good investment at the moment. Who knows how long this booking frenzy goes on for beach huts, but... Yeah. I'll go back, Georgie. I enjoyed it a lot. And I think it was a good way to kind of, you know, it was a really hot day. I would have had a different vibe if it was raining, if it just chucked down rain all day. I think, was this worth it? But I think, you know, I think it's still nice to have a little space. And it, because it was hot, And because we had a young daughter, we could take her into the shade. You know, we cooked up a little bit of lunch. We could have some refreshments. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, I was going to say, in summer, do you wonder no more what the purpose of beach huts
are? I wonder no more, Georgie. Good. Yeah, I'm not a beach lover, but if I did once a year in a beach hut, I'd be more than happy. I think nice. But would I buy one? Would I own one? Well, again, as my personal finance brain starts kicking in, I start thinking about things like liability insurance and actually just insurance in general and all of those kind of things that you just don't think about when you romanticize about something like this. I just start, my practical brain goes into gear and I think, no.
Yeah. And that's why you do what you do, Lee. And thank you for doing what you do. So we look forward to that column. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcast past and join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.